Hey everyone, welcome to the show. You know that feeling when you're chasing a dream but also want to stay true to yourself?
Yeah, well, that's kind of at the heart of this deep dive, the Bengals story.
It really is.
It's rock bio, but with a twist.
Yeah.
Like Almost Famous meets like a sisterhood saga
Yeah.
set against the 80s music scene. So before we unpack this, make sure to hit that like button and subscribe so you don't miss future deep dives.
Yes.
Our source today is Eternal Flame by Jennifer Otter Bickerdijk. Link in the description. Get ready for some aha moments about how the Bengals really rose to the top.
It's fascinating, really, how this book takes us beyond just the catchy tunes and the whole MTV image. It dives deep into the Peterson sisters' journey, Vicky and Debbie, from like a seemingly typical upbringing in the San Fernando Valley to becoming, rock icons. And it's a story about ambition, family bonds, and that constant struggle to balance artistic integrity with the demands of a male-dominated industry. Okay, so let's rewind to the beginning. Shopping mall is a five-bedroom house with a pool. I mean, that sounds like the quintessential American dream, right?
On the surface, yes, totally. But beneath that veneer of normalcy was this burning passion for music, specifically the Beatles. You know, their parents instilled a love for the Fab Four, taking them on annual road trips from California to Michigan, like all packed into a Buick LeSabre, with Beatles tunes filling the air.
Wow, talk about early musical immersion. It wasn't just casual listening, right? I mean, Vicky actually credits a specific TV appearance for sparking her musical ambitions.
Absolutely. Seeing the Cowsills, a family band, they predate the Partridge Family, on Ed Sullivan, it was a pivotal moment for a young Vicky. It planted the seed for a musical family of her own, a vision that would eventually manifest into, the Bengals.
Right.
Yeah.
It's amazing how a single event can just shape a person's trajectory. So Vicky starts sneaking into her dad's den to play his silver-tone jazz guitar, even rocking a plastic Sears guitar at a talent show. You can almost picture the scene.
And remember, their older sister Pam, full-blown Beatlemaniac, kept the sisters updated on all latest Beatles releases, fueling their obsession. And this deep love for the Beatles, it wasn't just a phase, it became the bedrock of their musical identity.
And then comes the move to Palos Verdes, where things really start to take shape. Vicky meets Amanda, another diehard Beatles fan, and they start jamming together, even recording themselves singing I Am Your Singer on a cassette player. It's almost like a scene from a coming-of-age movie.
And that's the beauty of their early years, those almost childlike experiments fueled by shared passion and a DIY spirit eventually evolved into something much bigger. They started performing at school events, covering Heart and Fleetwood Mac, even landed a gig at a local cafe. Remember, this was the late 70s,
Right.
at a time when all-girl rock bands were still fighting for a place at the table.
It's interesting how they went through a series of band names, Aisha, those girls each reflecting their growth as musicians and their evolving aspirations. And then Debbie, the younger Peterson sister, joins the band on drums.
Debbie's drumming is a remarkable story. She had never played drums before, but at her audition, they played Linda Ronstadt's Heatwave, and she just kept up. It was like this innate talent suddenly unleashed.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's incredible how natural talent can just emerge like that. So with the lineup solidified, Vicky, Debbie, Amanda, and a new bassist, and that by the LA club scene, navigating a world not always welcoming to female musicians.
Their early experiences playing at clubs owned by Rodney Bingenheimer, notorious for promoting a certain image of women in music, must have been eye-opening. Did it make them more determined to be seen as a serious rock band?
Absolutely. They witnessed how other all-girl bands like the Runaways were marketed, and they were determined to avoid that trap. They played the legendary Troubadour, soaking up the history and energy of the LA scene, but they were also wary of its pitfalls.
That awareness proved crucial when they met Miles Copeland, the manager of the Police and founder of IRS Records.
Right.
This was a turning point.
He saw their potential, their raw talent, and importantly, he didn't try to pigeonhole them as a poor person's go-gos. He saw them as a rock band whose members happened to be women.
It's refreshing to see a manager recognizing their individuality and not trying to fit them into a pre-existing mold. And this is where the name Bengals enters the picture.
Right. Remember, they were still called the Bangs, but a conflict with another band forced them to change. And it was Miles Copeland's partner, Mike Gormley, who suggested adding less, creating Bengals. Initially, they weren't thrilled, but, they owned it.
They embraced the name and made it synonymous with their unique sound, blending pop sensibilities with rock energy and those signature harmonies.
They signed to Faulty Products, a subsidiary of IRS Records, and released their debut EP. It showcased their songwriting skills and those incredible harmonies, laying the groundwork for what was to come.
But success wasn't instant. They hit the road, touring relentlessly, opening for bands like The English Beat and Cyndi Lauper. It was a grueling apprenticeship, honing their stage presence and building a fan base.
Speaking of fans, they had a fan club called Bangles and Mash. Can you imagine the quirky gifts and fan mail they must have received?
It's a testament to their growing popularity and how they connected with audiences. But they also witnessed the industry's complexities, the media's tendency to focus on their image rather than their music.
It must have been a constant battle to stay true to their vision amidst the pressures of the music industry.
It was. And that struggle would become even more pronounced as they signed with Columbia Records, embarked on their first full-length album, and encountered a certain producer named David Kahn. But that, my friend, is a story for part two of our deep dive. Signing with Columbia Records was a major step for the Bangles. You know, a leap from the indie world into the major leagues. It came with all the promises and pitfalls you'd expect, like bigger budgets, wider reach, but also the potential for losing creative control.
But they were ready, though, right? They went straight into recording their first full-length album for Columbia all over the place, armed with songs they'd honed in clubs for years.
Yes, and initially they were excited about the opportunity. Debbie in particular was proud of their raw rock sound on those early recordings. You know, they felt they were capturing their true essence as a band.
Right.
Yeah.
But then enters David Kahn, the producer. And it sounds like he had a very specific vision for the album, a vision that didn't necessarily align with the band's.
Exactly. Kahno, while undeniably talented, had a way of working that undermined the band's confidence. Instead of fostering collaboration, he focused on what he perceived as their flaws, you know, making them question their abilities. Susanna even described him as tormented, perhaps projecting his own unrealized artistic ambitions onto the band.
It's heartbreaking to hear how his critiques impacted them. Vicky felt her will was broken during those sessions, and Debbie was particularly affected. Connie's comments about her drumming and singing were so harsh that she thought she'd be kicked out of the band.
It's a classic example of how a producer's approach can make or break a band's spirit. The Bangles had this raw garage band energy, and Kahno wanted to polish it, refine it, almost to the point where it lost its original grit. And for a band that prided itself on its songwriting, having their creative input stifled was incredibly frustrating.
It's interesting, though, that despite the friction all over the place, did gain them recognition. They even landed a coveted spot opening for Cyndi Lauper on her Fun Tour, playing in huge arenas and exposing their music to a wider audience.
That tour was a pivotal moment. It not only boosted their visibility, but also gave them valuable experience performing on large stages. But it also exposed them to the harsh realities of the music industry, particularly the limitations placed on female artists.
What do you mean by limitations?
Well, back then, there were these unspoken rules about how many female artists could be on a radio station's playlist at any given time. It was incredibly limited, almost like they were competing for a single slot. It highlights how the industry, even while celebrating female artists, still imposed barriers to their success.
So when the Go-Go's, another popular all-girl band, broke up that same year, it created an unexpected opportunity for the Bangles.
It's a complex situation, right? You never want to see another band fail, but the Go-Go's breakup did create a void in the market, so to speak. It meant there was less competition for airtime and attention from labels.
And that's when Prince enters the picture, almost like a musical fairy godmother waving his magic wand and changing their destiny.
The story of how Prince came to give them Manic Monday is almost legendary. There are different versions, but what matters is that he, at the height of his fame, recognized something special in the Bangles.
It speaks volumes about his musical intuition. Manic Monday had this infectious pop sensibility different from his usual funk rock sound. It was almost Beatle-esque, with a catchy piano riff that just burrowed into your brain.
What's interesting is that the song's structure and chord progressions are quite complex despite its deceptively simple, catchy melody. It showcased Prince's songwriting genius and his ability to craft pop gems that were both accessible and musically sophisticated.
The Bangles being huge, Prince fans were floored when they received the demo. They knew they had something special. They included it on their next album, Different Light, and it became their breakout hit.
It shot to number two on the charts, held back only by Prince's own single Kiss, which was at number one. It's almost poetic, their song being eclipsed only by their musical idol.
Manic Monday was everywhere on MTV Radio Magazine covers. It launched them into a whole new stratosphere of fame.
It was a whirlwind of success, but with it came increased pressure, relentless touring, and even more scrutiny from the media.
And the media, as always, couldn't resist creating narratives, especially around Susanna and Prince. The rumors about a relationship between them, fueled by their supposed musical connection, further amplified Susanna's position within the band.
That media attention, while perhaps unintentional, contributed to a growing imbalance within the band. The spotlight was increasingly on Susanna, and the girl gang dynamic they had carefully cultivated was starting to fray at the edges.
Next, we'll explore how this newfound fame impacted their creative process, the challenges of working with David Kahn again, and the making of Walk Like an Egyptian, a song that would further solidify their place in music history. Okay, so we left off with Manic Monday, like catapulting the Bangles into superstardom. But fame, as we know, is a double-edged sword. While they were, you know, riding high, the pressures of success were also starting to create those cracks in their foundation.
Yeah, it really is almost like the Shakespearean tragedy playing out in the pop music world.
Right.
They achieved the dream, but the very elements that brought them success, the hit songs, the media attention, all the industry pressures also began to, like, tear them apart.
Their second album for Columbia, Different Light, was still under the watchful eye of David Kahn. Even with Manic Monday being such a smash, the recording process wasn't exactly smooth sailing.
Right.
Yeah.
Kahn was still fixated on crafting this polished pop sound, often bringing in session musicians and kind of pushing the band away from their rock roots. This created tension, particularly for Debbie, who felt like her drumming and vocal contributions were being minimized, you know, in favor of Susanna's lead vocals and a more commercial sound.
So the girl gang unity that they cherished was starting to unravel, replaced by this sense of competition and frustration.
Yeah, and this dynamic was further complicated by the arrival of Walk Like an Egyptian. It became another massive hit, but it also cemented Susanna's position as the band's focal point, especially with that iconic music video and her, you know, mesmerizing eye movements.
Right.
Yeah.
That video perfectly captures the 80s music scene.
Yeah.
The fusion of music and image. It wasn't just about the song. It was about the visuals, the personality, the whole package. And Susanna, whether intentionally or not, became the face of the Bangles.
And while they were achieving incredible things, selling out shows, winning awards, even performing at the Brit Awards alongside, you know, legends like George Harrison and Kate Bush, the internal conflicts were simmering beneath the surface.
Right. It must have been surreal experiencing that level of success while also dealing with the growing tensions within the band.
Susanna's burgeoning acting career also added another layer of complexity. Her role in the film The All-Nighter, while showcasing her talent, also took her away from the band, both physically and creatively. And the media, always eager for a story, started portraying it as Susanna versus, you know, the rest of the Bangles.
It's a familiar tale in music history, sadly. One member's success often overshadows the collective, creating friction and resentment.
Exactly. The internal dynamics were reaching a breaking point during the recording of their third album, Everything. They brought in a new producer, David Zidrisson, hoping for a more collaborative approach, but the damage was already done.
Right. And then there's the story of Eternal Flame. Susanna co-wrote the song believing it was one of her best, but the other band members weren't convinced. It almost didn't make the album.
Talk about a sliding doors moment. Eternal Flame became a global sensation, topping charts worldwide. But its success also highlighted the growing divide within the band.
It's ironic, isn't it? The song that became their biggest hit also symbolized their internal struggles.
The pressure, the exhaustion, the lack of open communication, it all came to a head during their 1989 world tour. Debbie had recently gotten married, but Susanna and Vicky didn't even attend her wedding. That's how strained their relationships had become.
It's heartbreaking to hear how those personal bonds, forged over years of shared dreams and experiences, were ultimately fractured by the weight of their success.
By the end of that tour, the Bangles were essentially finished. They officially announced their breakup in 1990, leaving fans devastated.
So what's the takeaway from this bittersweet tale? I mean, the Bangles achieved a level of success that most bands only dream of. But they also paid a heavy price. They lost their unity, their sense of sisterhood, and ultimately, their band.
Their story is a cautionary tale about the pitfalls of fame, the importance of communication, and the fragility of even the strongest bonds. It reminds us that behind the music, the image, the success, are real people with real emotions, you know, navigating complex relationships and trying to stay true to themselves in a demanding industry.
And it's also a story that resonates with so many artists, especially women who are trying to make it in a male-dominated field.
Yeah.
You know, the Bangles showed that it was possible to achieve your dreams, but also revealed the sacrifices that often come with success.
It's a story that continues to fascinate, to inspire, and to remind us that even the brightest flames can be extinguished if not carefully tended.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the Bengals story. What moment resonated most with you? Share your thoughts in the comments, and don't forget to subscribe for more fascinating deep dives.
And here's a final thought to ponder. Imagine the Bengals today. Could they reunite and recapture that magic in a music world vastly different from the 80s? It's a question that continues to intrigue fans, and, you know, only time will tell if the flame will ever burn as bright again.